everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guest will be Stacey Malkin. She is the co-founder and co-director of U.S. Right to Know, and she will be a guest at the Real Truth About Health Conference next week on January 27th. From 4 to 5:30, and we'll tell you more about that when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going in and around the news, some events that you might want to participate in, and, of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So I just returned from the NOFO Winter Conference, which was up in Syracuse this year. In years past, it has been in Saratoga Springs, but this year they moved it a little further north, in the hopes of getting more rural farmers from that side of the state, and I think it was successful. The theme was extending the table, and the workshops were just great. I found myself focusing mostly on the policy track, where we were learning better ways of lobbying and how to reach our congressmen, our legislators, how to get a bill passed. We were also talking about hunger issues and, food access issues and sustainability. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful conference. If you have a chance to come next year, I really highly recommend it. Next year we'll be back to Saratoga Springs, and going forward they're going to be alternating between Syracuse and Saratoga Springs. But it was really great. And then will be a summer conference which brings all the NOFAs together. NOFA stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And every New England state has a chapter. And NOFA New York is a very big, active one. But for the summer conference, it will be on the Amherst campus up in Amherst, Massachusetts. And it is the first weekend of August. And it brings all the NOFA chapters together, Vermont, Maine, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York. I even believe New Jersey has a chapter. But anyway, it's a wonderful opportunity to network and meet farmers and come together in that way. We will be having a CSA fair here on Long Island on March 26th, I believe. Which, you know, will bring all the local farms together, and you'll have an opportunity to shop around. Actually, it's March 21st, and it will be at the Sisters of St. Joseph, and it's just a great opportunity to meet the different farmers that are around. CSA, if you don't know what that stands for, it's Community Supported Agriculture, and it's a wonderful opportunity to find the local farms that are offering these programs, and it is the best way of getting local, seasonably grown, you know, that week's harvest. You can't get much fresher. And all the different CSAs have drop-off spots. Some of them you go to the farm. But community-supported agriculture programs really vary. Some of them have add-on opportunities for meat or flowers or fruit. And some of them are purely vegetables. Some of them have herbs. Some, like I said, you go to the farm to pick it up. Some have different drop-off points. So you need to find the one that's going to be most convenient, the program that's most convenient for you. Most of them have opportunities for you to come onto the farm and to maybe help out planting garlic or harvesting something. So it's a wonderful opportunity also to build community. So I highly recommend doing that. And then I also, this week was the fourth National Day of Racial Healing, actually on Tuesday. And so I went to a seminar that Erase Racism was having called How Do We Implement Change to Build a Just Long Island? And it was really great to be at the table with so many others on Long Island that really care about the racial inequality that exists here on the island. Seems that Newsday has done a big report. I don't get Newsday, so I hadn't seen it. But Long Island seems to be one of the most racially segregated areas in the whole country. And one neighborhood could be very affluent and have some of the best schools right next to another neighborhood that is really struggling. Wyandanch was one of the neighborhoods we were talking about. They have a 44% graduation rate in their high school. Can you imagine 44%? That's horrible. And when somebody does not finish high school, let alone not go to college, their chances of succeeding in the world are really much more challenged. And the chances of poverty continuing in that family is really great. The one way to really break the pattern of poverty is through education and for the next generation to get a good job and help lift the whole family up. And so talking about racism on Long Island with our neighbors was just really so uplifting, believe it or not. It really was. And there's hope that we can make some change, but we really need to all start talking about it. You know, it's like the elephant in the room. You don't really want to address it, but it's really necessary to address it if we're going to try to make it better. So that was really a wonderful, wonderful workshop. And, you know, stay tuned. Check out Erase Racism if you live in the Long Island area, or just, you know, if you live in other parts of the country, look into ways that you can help build relationships with people from other communities than your own so that we can have this cross-cultural and cross-racial discussions in how to build equity going forward. And that's been a real issue in the food movement, equity issues, food access issues. People do not like the word food desert, because that implies there's no food, when the reality is those neighborhoods have plenty of food. They're just the wrong kinds of food, lots of fast food. But try to get a fresh organic tomato in a neighborhood that's, you know, plagued with Pizza Hut and McDonald's and Wendy's and all those, you're going to be really challenged. So getting good food to those that need it is really great. One of the workshops I took up at the NOFA conference was with an organization called Food Link up in the Rochester area, and they actually have these big school buses that they converted into mobile produce buses that go into neighborhoods where they don't have supermarkets. And there's been a lot of write-ups recently about rural areas in this country that just can't support a supermarket. There's not enough people in the town. Supermarkets don't make enough money. There's, you know, the gas stations and the 7-Elevens and the bodegas in the area are, you know, providing enough frozen food and quick food that people can get by without going to a supermarket. So the supermarkets have closed, and without a good supermarket in a neighborhood, the likelihood of people eating well is really slim. So we need to, you know, get good food to those that need it, and it's all connected. That's one of the things that I love about food, is it does connect so many of the issues that we're struggling with, whether it's the economy, health, food access, poverty, environment. All these issues come together, and food and bringing people to the table is really one of the best ways to address them. So a few things you want to know about if you are in the New York area. January 24th is a meet, greet, and eat being sponsored by Slow Food South Shore. Slow Food is a great organization. If you don't know of it, check out a Slow Food chapter in your local area. Just go to slowfoodusa.org and plug in your zip code, and you'll find a chapter close to you. But Slow Food really is an organization working towards good, clean, and fair food for everybody. And it's a wonderful organization. I run our local chapter. We will be hosting a film called Secret Ingredients on January 26th at the Landmark on Main Street in Port Washington at 3 o'clock, and that's a free event. Jeffrey Smith, the filmmaker, will be there talking about the film, and I will be there moderating, following the film, and it's just so important that we know about what's lurking in our food that's making us sick that we do not know about. And we'll certainly be talking about that more today with my guest, Stacy, in just a few minutes. Also, on February 12th, the Climate Wednesdays come back to the Brooklyn Public Library. The theme will be Our Bodies, Our Planet, and it's the climate crisis, and they are talking about so many issues revolving around climate and how they affect different things. So come on out to that. That is also a free event at the Brooklyn Public Library on February 12th. And I mentioned before the Real Truth About Health Conference. That's a 10-day free conference starting January 24th through February 2nd. They have so many wonderful, wonderful speakers at this conference. It's amazing, and it's free, and they will be providing great plant-based food for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and also vegan ice cream for desserts. So definitely check out the website, The Real Truth About Health Conference, and see all the speakers that will be there and find some speakers that you want to hear. On February 13th, I'll be heading down to the Sustainable Kashi Ashram in Sebastian, Florida for a cooking class, One Wok, Three Meals, and that's one of my favorite classes to teach. It really just lays out all these vegetables and shows you how you can mix and match different vegetables and create different main courses with an international flair. So I'll be doing an Indian curry, I'll be doing a Mediterranean dish, and I'll be doing one other. I'm not even sure what the third one will be yet. But if you're in Florida, come visit me at the Kashi Sustainable Ranch. And now it's my pleasure to introduce all of you. I forgot. I have to give you my recipe. Oh, the recipe this week was great. I did zucchini noodles puttanesca with fire-roasted tomatoes, capers, and olives. And this is just a lighter take than using pasta. Of course, it makes it gluten-free, and it's just so satisfying. It's just like having a big plate of pasta, but instead it's zucchini noodles. So you need to get a spiralizer. They have so many different ones. There's handheld ones that are really inexpensive. You can get it on Amazon or at your local Bed Bath & Beyond. But you want a way of spiralizing your zucchini. And I used 4 zucchinis, which is enough for 6 people. 1 organic onion that I diced, about 2 cups worth. 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic. 6 to 8 organic cremini mushrooms that I sliced, and that was about 2 cups as well. 1 yellow pepper, diced, 2 tablespoons of organic tomato paste, 1 large can of organic fire-roasted tomatoes, 1/4 cup of small capers, 1/4 cup to 1/2 teaspoon of red chili flakes, and that's optional. If you don't like spice, you can just certainly leave it out. 1/4 cup is just a little, a quarter teaspoon is just a little bit of a spice. 1/2 teaspoon is more. You can just serve it with the red pepper flakes on the side, too, and let people add their own if you'd like. 1 teaspoon oregano, 1 teaspoon of basil. That's both dried oregano and dried basil. 1 cup of organic Kalamata olives that I sliced in half. 1/2 cup of chopped Italian parsley with the stems removed. So just chop the leaves. 1/4 cup of white wine, salt and pepper to taste, and I started with 1/4 cup of olive oil in the bottom of a wok. And I actually cooked this in a wok because I wanted there to be enough space to add the zucchini noodles at the end. So I covered the bottom of the wok with the olive oil, and when that was hot, I added the onions, and I cooked those for about 5 minutes on medium heat. You want to get them translucent. You don't want them to burn. Then you add the garlic and the mushrooms and cook those for a few more minutes, like another 5 minutes. Then I pushed those vegetables to the side and I added the 2 tablespoons of tomato paste to the center of the wok and let that cook for a few minutes. And by toasting the tomato paste, it really changes the flavor a bit and brings out a really wonderful, deep umami flavor to the tomato paste. Then I added the peppers and the white wine, the oregano and the basil and the red pepper flakes to that and mixed that all up and cooked another few minutes. Then I added the fire-roasted tomatoes, the olives, and the capers, seasoned it with salt and pepper, and just cooked that for a little bit, let all those flavors come together. Then I added the spiralized zucchini and the chopped parsley and cooked that for just a few minutes. So you let the zucchini, you don't want to totally wilt it. You want to keep a little bit of a crunch to it, but you want it to all get warm and come together. And then I added most of the parsley, but I saved like a tablespoon of parsley just for the garnish on top, and that was it. It's a really quick, easy, middle-of-the-week meal, and it's just delicious. So check that out, and, of course, let me know how you like it. I love comments from all of my listeners. It makes it all worthwhile. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Stacy Malkin to all of you. She is the co-founder and co-director of U.S. Right to Know, which is a nonprofit investigative research group that's focused on the food industry. She's also the author of the award-winning book, Not Just a Pretty Face, The Ugly Side of the Beauty Industry, and co-founder of the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, which is a coalition of nonprofit health and environmental groups that inspired cosmetic companies to remove hazardous chemicals from nail polish, baby products, makeup, and hair products. Stacy's work has been published in Time Magazine, in New York Times, Washington Post, and many others. She's appeared in Teen Vogue, Wall Street Journal, and I could go on and on, as well as several documentary films, including The Human Experiment, produced by Sean Penn, Pink Skies and Stink Movie, which you can actually see on Netflix now. In 2012, Stacy served as media director for the historic California Right to Know ballot initiative, which I was very involved in trying to promote, you know, which is all about labeling genetically engineered foods. And she'll tell us why that maybe didn't pass during our discussion in a little bit. And she's the former communication director for Healthcare Without Harm, which got mercury out of hospitals and closed down medical waste incinerators around the world. And prior to her work in environmental health, Stacy worked for 8 years as a journalist and managing editor, and she published an investigative newspaper covering land use and environmental issues in Colorado. And as I mentioned before, she will be at the Real Truth About Health conference on Monday, January 27th, from 4 to 5:30, talking about spinning food, how pesticide industry PR tactics shape the story of the food we eat. And she now lives in the Bay Area with her husband and son. And I want to thank you so much, Stacy, for joining me. How are you?
Thank you. Good. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me, Bhavani.
Sure. So I talked a lot about your history, but how did you first get, what was your passion? How did you first get involved in the food industry and, you know, health? I mean, I guess you started with the cosmetics. How did you first get involved with this?
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction, too. And it sort of dates me, as I've been doing this for a very long time. And I started out as a reporter, as you mentioned, covering politics and land use issues and environmental issues. And that was fascinating to sort of get inside of what was happening on a community level with environmental degradation and environmental problems in the mountains, which were many due to development and sort of the control that developers had over local politics. And I started to learn at that time about chemicals used for agriculture and really some alarming statistics just about how pesticides impact health and how little is known actually about the pesticides that are in our foods and also sprayed all over the place in terms of the community I lived in. They were sprayed on the bike paths and the schools and lawns and parks to control weeds. And I started to ask scientists and local officials at that time when I was covering the story in the 90s, you know, what do you know about the health effects of these chemicals? And it really was clear to me that very little, and that the companies were really largely controlling knowledge and understanding and public dialogue, as well as the regulations about what was happening with chemicals in the environment. So that sort of became my passion to understand what's going on and to figure out how to help the public to understand what science is saying about the links between chemicals in our products and in our food and in our health and the environment.
Uh-huh. And when you're speaking at the Real Truth About Health conference, what's the main message that you want to share, you know, to the public? What's, you know, right now, what do you think is the most important message to get out there?
Well, I've been studying for the last several years how the pesticide industry is really dominating the debate about our food system. And that's a story worth telling, sort of how and why we started U.S. Right to Know. But just to jump to the answer to your question, and we have many, many internal documents that we've gotten from companies over the past several years that give a window into what's going on behind the scenes in science, regulatory institutions, media, with the story of our food, which a story that many of us hear is that we need pesticides to feed the world. We need to double down on this intensive industrial agriculture system in order to feed a growing population. And that's a story that's very intentionally spun by the pesticide industry. What I'm going to be talking about at the conference, which I'm excited about, it's really a new talk because it's taking together all of the latest research that we have to say, here's what we found from documents, from their own words, showing what is really a massive propaganda effort on many levels of society that is really, to the extent of, I think, as dangerous as, and I would argue even more successful than, the oil industry's efforts to shape the debate around climate change and deny the science around climate change. And I think it's important for people to understand the extent of it, to see through to the truth, and to really figure out how we can have a more honest debate about the serious issues facing our food system. As we see science coming in recently, just in the last couple of years, about crashing insect populations, die-offs of bees that are crucial to the food system, rising rates of cancers among farmers, and just many signs that the chemicals that we're spraying all over our food are having a significant negative impact on not only health and ecology, but on our ability to produce food into the future.
Mm-hmm. And yet they still want you to think that without them, we wouldn't have enough food and that the pesticides are really making a difference, and the monoculture that, you know, the way that they're growing is the best way to do it. And as you know, and we know, it's really not. Do you know about the subsidies? Like why all of the subsidies are going to the farmers that are doing this kind of growing?
Well, I mean, the system is just so greatly imbalanced to favor what the agrochemical corporations want. It's truly, the extent of it, again, is incredible. There was just a story this week in The Intercept by Li Fang, an amazing reporter, and I think he spent more than a year putting this together. The headline is "The Pesticide Industry's Playbook for Poisoning the Planet," and he goes through the many, many ways that pesticide companies have warped the debate, hid the science, denied the science on chemicals called neonicotinoids, which are greatly implicated in bee die-offs and crashing insect populations, but which we've not been able to regulate at all in the U.S. Because of you know, all the stuff that I'm going to be talking about at the conference, the many, many ways that pesticide companies are controlling this debate, from funding that they give to universities to the incredible power they have over regulatory institutions. Stories in there, for example, about scientists who raise concerns about pesticides and bees getting demoted or investigated or sidelined, whereas industry people are put forth to be in charge of all the programs. So out of that comes a subsidy program that is just ridiculous, as with the oil industry, that really incentivizes, you know, more and more monocultures, larger farms, and incentivizes using that land not for food, but for ethanol and for biofuels. So it's really incredible to look at the Midwest of this country being planted largely with corn and soy, most of which isn't even used for food. It's used for the biofuels, it's used for animal feed. And it's causing huge problems for soil degradation, chemical runoff, farmer health, et cetera. So it's an insane system, bottom line. And it really takes these massive propaganda efforts to keep it going. Like, they actually cannot continue business as usual without this side business, sort of a cottage industry, except it's huge. There's nothing small about it. And that's the PR firms, front groups, and propaganda efforts, including, you know, being embedded in the most prestigious universities in the United States, as well as our regulatory institutes that are supporting and fueling the system of disinformation.
Yeah. Right. And also, you know, they buy journalists as well. You know, I mean, there's so many, you know, I have seen so many journalists who also, you know, can be bought by Monsanto or, you know, work for Monsanto. And, you know, so you have to really know who's reporting and where the information's coming from. Can you talk a little bit about U.S. Right to Know, the organization that you co-founded, and when did you start it, and what are you working on right now?
Yeah, so we started U.S. Right to Know at usrtk.org, and we're a small group, just 3.5 of us. I work part-time, so I'm the half. I started it with my co-director, Gary Ruskin, in 2015, and we worked together on the California ballot initiative to label genetically engineered foods, and that was a crash course in the many ways that the pesticide industry comes after its critics. The most surprising, because we lost that campaign, despite the fact that there were 70%, very consistent 70%, of people across the board were supportive of labeling GMOs. And we lost that campaign due to basically a 30-day advertising blitz during which the chemical company spent about $1 million a day on massive disinformation ads. The surprising thing to us, though, was the legion of supporters that they had going along with them, speaking the untrue industry talking points. So academics, lawyers, Nobel laureates, I mean, just so many front groups and such a sophisticated sort of information coming at reporters and the media from all angles, such that they didn't even see the disinformation. So after that experience, very upsetting, we really wanted to know, how are they doing that? Like, what's behind that system? How does the money work? How does the coordination work? So a few years later, were able to put together some funding to start U.S. Right to Know and launch an investigation to try to look for documents and find information about how things are working behind the scenes. And my colleague Gary is a brilliant public interest researcher. He filed many Freedom of Information Act requests in universities across the country and around the world, as well as government requests for FOIAs and many ways of trying to get at public records. And we were able to obtain many, many documents. We have tens of thousands of pages of documents from our investigation. Many of them are now posted at the UCSF Chemical Industry Library, so you can look online and search for the documents. And along with that, we've also been tracking, reading, and posting all of the documents coming out of the Roundup cancer trials, where Bayer Monsanto was on trial for charges that glyphosate Roundup causes cancer and that they had covered up the risk. So there have been 3 trials on that, all of which were unanimous jury decisions in favor of the plaintiffs who had cancer, and those trials are going on. So we cover those very closely. We read these and analyze these documents. So that's sort of the background that forms the reporting of U.S. Right to Know. So we're really looking at and reporting at how companies are manipulating behind the scenes regulatory, academic, media institutions, and public opinion about our food.
Mm-hmm. And what's happening with those Roundup cancer trials? I know I read about 2 that were awarded really big, huge settlements, but what's happening now? I know there's, I think there's hundreds, right? Aren't there hundreds of trials pending?
Thousands, actually, up to 45,000.
And how many?
Actually,
how many?
They're up 45,000, and I'm hearing even up to 75,000. is what they're possibly expecting. But it's at least 45,000. Many of them groundskeepers or farmers that had long-term exposures to Roundup and now have non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Actually, today, the fourth trial started in St. Louis, but there's a mad rush to try to settle. So there's rumors going on about settlement talks and that any moment they might reach a settlement. So we don't know. There's certainly a lot of pressure among Bayer's investors and people within the company that want to settle, but they're looking at a huge amount that they'll have to pay out. So you can follow on our website my colleague Carrie Gillum. She wrote a book about glyphosate, and she is tracking the trials as more closely than anyone. She's really breaking a lot of news and documents on our website in her Roundup Trial Tracker and also on her Twitter feed, Carrie Gillum.
What is her feed?
It's a fascinating, any moment we could hear big news. You can find her at Carrie, C-A-R-E-Y, Gillum, G-I-L-L-A-M, on Twitter. Or just go to our website, usrtk.org, and you'll see right at the top the Roundup Trial Tracker. And she's writing blogs, sometimes daily, every other day, really breaking a lot of news about what's happening when with the trials.
Wow. So amazing. I can't believe Bayer bought Monsanto. Who would want to buy that, right? They had to know that there's all this stuff pending.
There's a lot of speculation about why. Why did they do it? And investors are not happy. Yeah.
I wouldn't think
so. My answer to that is they believe their own BS. They really thought they were not going to be held liable for these cancers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what made you switch from, you know, cosmetics? You know, your book was just such a huge hit, not just A Pretty Face, The Ugly Side of the Beauty Industry, because not many people really, at least back then, were really talking about what's in cosmetics and nail polish. You really kind of opened up a whole Pandora's box. Can you talk about that and then what made you change?
Sure, and thank you for that. That was a lot of fun to work on the cosmetics industry, and we did break lots of stories about chemicals and cosmetics, and also were able to get companies to make some big changes. So that was very gratifying, although it's still a problem that many of our personal care products contain known toxic chemicals. I changed to food in 2012 because I wanted to work on this labeling campaign. But my real motivation at the heart of that was that that was a grassroots campaign really led by women and many of the moms who were petitioning for GMO labeling, who really worked hard to get that question on the ballot, which is a major endeavor. They got, I think, almost 1 million signatures in a 10-day period is what you have to do to get on the ballot in California. And I was so inspired by the women and moms who were in that fight, and a lot of them hadn't been involved in politics before. And I just thought, this is such a movement of women that I want to understand, because they were as passionate as all the women I was working with on Safe Cosmetics, but it was kind of a different group. So I thought, if we could get all of these women concerned about health and environmental issues together into a political movement, I just think that would be unstoppable, and that's what we need to do to really fix these issues, because all of them, and you said something along these lines earlier, you said you've been working on policy and interested in policy. All of these issues are policy issues: hunger, food safety, labeling transparency, what's happening on our farms, to the soil, to the environment. It's all policy. So we've got to get politically active in order to fix or change them. So that was my hope. You know, that was my big dream. It's challenging in practice. But the other thing I noticed when I switched was that the chemical industry, the pesticide industry, it's really a lot of the same companies, right, are, of course, making chemicals and cosmetics or the pesticides. But the pesticide industry is a whole different ballgame than the beauty industry in terms of the sophisticated nature of their propaganda efforts and how embedded they are with media and regulatory institutions and academia. So they're just operating on a whole other level of subterfuge and really covert, disingenuous, underhanded tactics in order to keep going with their poisoning of our food system.
Yeah, it's so true. And yet at the same time, you know, the cosmetic industry also covers, you know, that would also cover, you know, sunscreen and things like that. And that always blows me away when young parents don't know and they're putting sunscreen with heavy chemicals all over their children. And we all know skin is your largest organ and it absorbs everything. And it would make me crazy watching, you know, especially with all the info about, you know, kids shouldn't be get any sun now, you know, instead of sun being something good, they, you know, and, or just putting long sleeve clothing on them, they're just lathering them up with sunscreen day in and day out. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's true, and not only are many of those products toxic, but researchers have also found that a lot of them don't actually offer the protection that they say they do. So you really got to do your research on sunscreen. And there's some great work on that by the Environmental Working Group. They do a report every year about safe sunscreens, and they look at both efficacy and toxicity, and they give recommendations for better options. And there are good companies that are making safe sunscreens, and the safer ingredients being zinc oxide or titanium dioxide, not in nanoparticle form, but just the regular. Sometimes people don't like them because they're chalky white and harder to rub in. But that's right. What I use on my son, or as you said, long sleeve or just time out in the shade. But yeah, I mean, I've being a relatively new mom, my son's just 5, but the moms who like, they don't let their kids' skin see an inch of the sun, just like not even a shred. It's kind of amazing. Yeah.
Right, vitamin D, you know, you're just going out for a little bit, a little walk, a little, you know, it's one thing if you're lying in the sun or you're going to the beach. But just for regular activity, you know, I think there's this over paranoia about the sun. And, you know, we all need some vitamin D. I mean, how many people have vitamin D deficiencies these days because they don't get into the sun?
Yeah, most of us.
Right. That's a problem, too. Joining us, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest is Stacey Malkin, the co-founder and co-director of the U.S. Right to Know. And right before our break, we were talking about sunscreen and the chemicals used in the beauty industry. And I wanted to switch over now and talk about some of the chemicals that are in our food that are most disturbing. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes, unfortunately, there are lots of them. And just to name a few examples, I mentioned neonicotinoids earlier, really strongly implicated in bee deaths and insect die-offs, and banned in Europe, but used here. And this is the story with several of the chemicals I'm about to mention. They're banned in Europe, but we can't get them banned here because the pesticide industry has so much power over our government and policy. Atrazine is another example. That's a widely used pesticide that has been shown to cause gender-bending effects in frogs. So frogs that have actually eggs in their testes. This is not a normal situation for frogs. And glyphosate, which is widely used on corn and soy in the U.S., also around the world. It's the most widely used herbicide in the world. And that's linked to cancer, but also various other effects like impact on the gut microbiome, which I think is of huge concern and really a new area that we're learning a lot about, that gut bacteria is sort of a control command central for health and for lots of functions for our body. Chlorpyrifos is very toxic to developing brains, and the EPA scientists even wanted us to ban it, and we were set to ban it, and the Trump administration reversed that ban. So that's another example of a chemical that would not be used in other countries that is widely used here. But to answer your main question, like what am I most concerned about, it's not any one thing, it's all of this. It's the mixtures of dozens and dozens of low levels of pesticides, many of which we know are problematic, but very little of which we know about the combined and synergistic effects and low-level exposures over time. So I buy organic, and that's not a perfect solution, but that's what we have, and I think it's important to support that system, and I think it's especially also important to think about when you're pregnant and for small children and babies, and for some foods more than others. You know, I think wheat is a really important one to try to buy organic wheat and grains. And then some vegetables more so than others. And again, EWG does a good job of listing out the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. I think they use phrases like that to say that some fruits and vegetables are way more problematic than others. So strawberries, for example, are at the top of the list of things to worry about. And avocados would be at the top of the list of things to not worry as much about.
Right, right. Yeah, there's so many things to think about when you're talking about food and our food system. And as you said before, organic, even though it's not perfect, it's the best we have. I mean, you know, the GMO project, you know, to make sure that something's genetically, you know, doesn't have genetic modified ingredients is also really important. But the organic industry, not only by buying that are you protecting your body, but you're also supporting those that are doing the right thing, that are helping to mitigate climate change, sequester carbon into the atmosphere, and humane treatment of animals, and, you know, the list goes on of the good things that they're doing, and those are the people you want to support.
Yes.
Yeah.
The better deal for farmers, too. Farmers are making more money on organic if they can switch, and I think policies that enable farmers to switch over and give them ways to do that and shift the subsidies from the bad toward the better are really important.
Right, and that's the kind of thing that has to happen through policy and through people becoming more politically active. And I've never been one, well, I shouldn't say that. It's been a long time now that I have been, but, you know, when I was younger, I wasn't, you know, involved in politics so much. And now I'm realizing so much is revolves around lobbying your local legislators and, you know, getting it on the state level. As a matter of fact, New York State recently put a ban on glyphosate. So in New York, glyphosate is no longer going, I don't know when it becomes law, but I know it was now passed by Governor Cuomo. So, you know, we're going in the right direction, but with our current administration, you really need to work on the local level because nothing's going to get through on the federal level with this administration. So we really have to work locally to make change.
Yeah.
What do you
see
as the
Go ahead. I was going to say, I was also not into politics when I was young, and I grew up in New England in Boston, and it seemed like it was very much a cultural thing. You don't talk about politics or religion. Like, it was impolite to talk about politics, certainly to argue about politics. So that's something I'm trying to get over, the discomfort. And it is, especially these days, which things so divisive. It's upsetting, the arguments and the craziness, but I think we have no choice but to go there and just, you know, put our energies and our hearts to what we believe in. And like you said, at the local level, it's incredibly important. New York has done wonderful things to protect people from chemicals much more than the federal government. So, and we've done some things in California, too. It really does matter. And local governments, too. And school districts are all places where we can get involved to raise concerns about pesticides, because a lot of this stuff is, as I said, sprayed on lawns where kids are playing. So we can do better there, too.
Absolutely. You know, I've been hired as the farm-to-school coordinator for a local public school, and I'm trying to, you know, work with the school district to really bring more food education into the students' consciousness, because right now, you know, parents might be wanting healthier food, but the kids just, you know, don't seem to care. You know, it seems like there's very little involvement or very little knowledge about what's good food versus bad food, and we have such a long way to go in our public schools. It's just amazing, you know, all the subsidized food that goes to food pantries also comes to schools. You know, it's free commodity food. And, you know, as a matter of fact, one thing that always cracks me up is that the vegetables we eat are called specialty crops. They're not the soy and the corn and all that. All those crops that we don't eat, those are regular agricultural products. But foods that we eat are called specialty crops.
That says it all right there, really. And good for you for getting involved in the schools, because I think that's super important to get kids thinking and talking about healthy food. That's hard, I know. But the power that school districts have, and hospitals too, and cities, to shift the food system is incredible, because they have so much buying power.
Mm-hmm. So what is U.S. Right to Know working on right now?
Well, we are continuing to report about what we find in the documents. I've been writing about front groups and third-party allies that the companies use to sort of, you know, fool the public by acting as like they're independent as they work behind the scenes and coordinate with pesticide companies. So I do a lot of writing about those issues on our website and coming out with a new report about what we know about the propaganda playbook that will be out in the next couple months. And we're tracking the Roundup Cancer trials, as I mentioned, posting frequently news from the trials, documents from the trials. And then we also have a very robust investigation into the soda industry and processed food industries and how they work behind the scenes to shape science and influence journalists, and basically try to shift the conversation about obesity away from bad food and sugary foods and toward the idea that
lack
we all
need to exercise or something
more.
Like that.
Yeah, we need to exercise, exactly.
I've heard those reports.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So really, you know, what it's all about is to try to distract people from policy, from coming together and taking collective action to regulate these companies. So that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as the biggest barriers to building a healthier food system? You know, do we need to hire PR companies that to counter the other peer? I mean, you know, the problem is we the people don't have the same kind of money that these companies have. So they can spend all this money on PR. You know, how do we combat them? How do we come back at them so that our message gets out there louder?
Well, that's a great question, and I think about it all the time. The good news is, I don't exactly have the answer, but I can tell you the good news is things are changing dramatically because people are changing what they buy. And I think people are changing what they buy because kids are sick, because young women are sick, they're having trouble getting pregnant, and women are sharing information with other women about how to solve those problems, how to find health, how food is medicine and can heal us. And because of that growing consciousness, I think we're seeing increasing purchasing of organic, and people want to know what's in their food. And this has been a major trend for some years, and it's really disrupting the food industry. The largest food companies have been losing lots of money. Their trade association broke up recently. Their CEOs have been leaving. It's an industry that's in the midst of major disruption. And so it's a good time to be, you know, pushing these issues. I think talking to our friends and our communities and sharing information and creating communities of knowledge where we can make it easier for people to find the information they need for health and find the people who can help support them. I think all of that, and to whatever extent we can support it and grow it, is hugely important and is changing the food system. So we got to keep at it and ramp it up, which I think means for all of us just being braver and louder in our own communities and taking those steps also into politics to try to take back our government to create one that works for the people and not just for the companies.
Absolutely. And do you have any campaigns going on that people should sign up on to help, or do you partner with other organizations that are really doing that on the ground, trying to sign petitions and write our local legislators and stuff to make this change happen?
We have not done much in the way of legislative work or petitions, although many, many wonderful groups that we work with do. Friends of the Earth is doing great work on food. I mentioned to the Environmental Working Group, the Center for Food Safety, Organic Consumers Association. Those are some groups that are doing great work. What I would love for people to do is sign up for our newsletter, and you can get the latest news on the U.S. Right to Know investigation, and tell your friends about it at usrtk.org. And our philosophy, and I mentioned we're a tiny staff, so we're trying to be super focused on reporting and documenting, and just truth-telling, reporting, documenting. Here's what we found, and hopefully producing information that other groups and activists and everyone, people in companies, people in government, can use to push for better policies.
Yeah, and that's it again, policy, right? We really have to push for better policy. But as you said, when the companies start feeling it in their pockets, that's when they are into making change. But another thing that we all have to watch out for is so often the wonderful organic companies that we grow to love then get bought out by some of these bigger companies, and then they change. And, you know, they already have established consumer loyalty. And so once, I mean, I've been shocked, you know, you know a product and you know the ingredients are clean and you've been buying them, and all of a sudden it's in your refrigerator and you take a peek and it's like, what? What is this doing in there? You know, and they've changed the ingredients. And, I mean, I had two jars of Just Mayo, which is like a vegan mayo that came out. I had two different jars, and they had, the labels looked the same. They had two different sets of ingredients. One came from Whole Foods, and one came from Costco.
Wow, you know? That's weird.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that one before, but yes, that's a true and a very disturbing trend about the corporate buyouts of the beauty brands as well as the food brands that are good and better, and then we see changes. Yeah.
Right.
So buy local, make your own, buy your own, grow your own, support people who do.
And then keep looking at the ingredients. Just because it was a good product one month doesn't mean it's going to stay a good product, you know, a few months down the line. Because if they get bought out by someone, then they change, you know. And those companies, those big companies, are pushing for even weakening the organic regulations. So we need everybody who's in support of organic to stay active and know what's going on, because we need to keep the organic standards stringent so that they don't get changed. Because I know they've tried to change the rules so that, like, you can say something's organic tomatoes, but if it happens that there's, you know, a bad crop and they can't get organic tomatoes, they don't have to change their label just for that time. They still can say organic tomatoes, even if they're not using organic tomatoes, which is horrifying. You know?
Yes, that is. Oh, I know. One of my neighbors works for a vitamin company that just got bought by General Mills. And he's like, oh, it's just so depressing. I mean, they've done it. Yeah, it's a very conflicting and a big problem. But it's a concentration of everything that's happening in every industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's losing is consumer choice, consumer satisfaction. There's no recourse for consumers. And, of course, we don't really have a seat at the table in policy and regulations either.
Right.
So we've got to reclaim
that. And companies like Whole Foods are starting to make all their own brands. So, like, the brands that you really did like, all of a sudden they're not getting shelf space because, you know, that shelf space is so important, you know, whether you get the middle shelf or whether you're all the way at the bottom where no one can find you. And so, you know, I'm seeing Whole Foods, for instance, dropping many of the products that I used to buy there because they can, and because they're making their own product now. And, you know, you just don't know if the standards are the same.
You're right. I've been noticing that, too, at Whole Foods, and I've been going there less, I have to say.
Yeah. So, everyone, you know, you just have to, you can't let up. You can't stop. You have to keep it up, keep that, you know, commitment to organic and transparency going so that you know what you're buying and you don't get fooled because they're really good. Like you said, Stacey, they are so good at spinning the myth and trying to make it seem like it's not a problem, or that, you know, GMOs don't really matter, or, you know, they just work really hard at that and spend millions and millions of dollars to fool us. So
anyway, when GMOs are starting to sneak in, that's one last thing to mention. They're sneaking in lots of different places they weren't before. There again, just organic or non-GMO label becomes very important. And the non-GMO project has been great about saying no new GMOs, no synthetic biology, just real food.
Although I've heard there's even such a backlog backlog with the non-GMO project. You know, they're getting so many places that want their product reviewed, and they're just backlogged. So getting to them is hard as well. But Stacey, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I really hope to see you at the Real Truth About Health Conference on Monday, January 27th from 4 to 5:30. And everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. And Stacey, just real quick, why don't you share your website one more time?
You can find me at usrtk.org, U.S. Right to Know. And thank you so much, Bhavani, for everything that you do and for the show. And please do come up and say hi at the conference. I'd love to meet you.
I certainly will. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I'll see you all again next week. And maybe I'll see you at the conference. Bye for now.